October Brazil. We're only seconds away from the new year.
And the new millennium?
You think the millennium bug is as serious as they say?
We'll soon find out, General.
Some claim the millennium bug means the end of civilization as we know it. Those guys are just cranks, right? Loonies?
Probably. Before the year 1000, there were all sorts of dire predictions about the end of the world, but nothing happened. And then before 2000, there was a millennium bug that was supposed to wreak havoc with all the computers in the world.
Computers?
Yes, computers were primitive brainods. They called their millennium bug Y2K. Capital Y, small k. Like ours, it was supposed to strike exactly at midnight, but nothing terrible occurred. Today, we have recourse to safety tools that our ancestors back then couldn't even dream of. So...
the countdown's starting.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It ought to shoot! The Millennium Bug!
It's gigantic! It's
over! Watch out for the overflow!
National Public Radio presents a Hollywood Theater of the Ear production, Beyond 2000. A radio series devoted to stories of the next millennia. Now, here is your host, the award-winning writer and critic,
You have just heard Robert Foxworth and Norman Lloyd in The Millennium Bug by Itzhak Perl. Was it etymology or entomology? Wordplay about bugaboos can be so bewildering. But here we are again, all of you and all of me, your insectoid interlocutor, Harlan Ellison, fresh from the honeydew mines of Mercury, and all a splat to proffer yet another programme of futuristic fables. Our outing this time pays merveilleux homage to the millennial moment, if you'll forgive us that bug business, beginning with a charming travelogue from the pen of, improbably, Hans Christian Andersen. Not content to surmise merely about mermaids and trolls and miniaturized protagonists, the mythmaker considers what the world will be like in 1,000 years.
Yes, in 1,000 years, people will fly on wings of steam through the air, over the ocean. The young inhabitants of America will become visitors of old Europe. They will come over to see the monuments and the great cities, which will by then be in ruins, just as we in our time make pilgrimages to the tottering splendors of Southern Asia. Yes, in 1,000 years, they will come. The Thames, the Danube, and the Rhine still roll their course. Mont Blanc stands firm with its snow-capped summit, and the northern lights gleam over the lands of the north. But generation after generation has become dust. Whole rows of the mighty of the moment are forgotten, like those who already slumber under the hill on which the rich trader who owns the land has built a bench on which he can sit and look out across his waving cornfields. To Europe, cry the young sons of America, to the land of our ancestors, the glorious land of monuments and fancy. To Europe! The ship of the air comes. It is crowded with passengers, for the transit is quicker than by sea. The electromagnetic wire under the ocean has already telegraphed the number of the aerial caravan. Europe is in sight. It is the coast of Ireland that they see, but the passengers are still asleep. They will not be called till they are exactly over England. There they will first step on European shore, in the land of Shakespeare, as the educated call it, the land of politics, the land of machines, as it is called by others. Here, They stay a whole day. That is all the time the busy race can devote to the whole of England and Scotland. Then the journey is continued through the tunnel under the English Channel to France. The land of Charlemagne and Napoleon. Molière is named. The learned men talk of the classic school of remote antiquity. There is rejoicing and shouting for the names of heroes, poets, and men of science whom our time does not know, but who will be born after our time in Paris, the center of Europe, and elsewhere. The air steamboat flies over the country whence Columbus set forth, where Cortez was born, and where Calderon sang dramas in sounding verse. Beautiful, dark-eyed women live still in the blooming valleys, and the oldest songs speak of El Cid and the Alhambra. Then, through the air, over the sea, to Italy, where once lay old, everlasting Rome. It has vanished. The Campania lies desert. A single ruined wall is shown as the remains of St. Peter's, but there is a doubt if this ruin be genuine. Next, to Greece. To sleep only one night in the Grand Hotel at the top of Mount Olympus, just to say that they have been there. And the journey is continued to the Bosphorus, to rest there a few hours and see the place where Byzantium lay, and where legend says that the harem stood in the time of the Turks. Poor fishermen are now spreading their nets. Over the remains of mighty cities on the broad Danube, cities which we in our time know not, the travelers pass, but here and there, on the rich sites of those that time shall bring forth, the caravan sometimes descends and departs thence again. Down below lies Germany, that was once covered with a close net of railways and canals, the region where Luther spoke, where Goethe sang, and Mozart once held the scepter of harmony. Great names shine there in science and in art, names that are unknown to us. One day devoted to seeing Germany, and one for the north, the country of Ørsted and Linnaeus, and for Norway, the land of the old heroes and the young Normans. Iceland is visited on the journey home. The geysers burn no more. Hekla is an extinct volcano. But the rocky island is still fixed in the midst of the foaming sea, a continual monument of legend and poetry. There is really a great deal to be seen in Europe, says the young American, and we have seen it all. According to the directions of a great traveler, and here he mentions the name of one of his contemporaries, in his celebrated work, How to See All of Europe in a Week.
Saturday afternoon matinees at the Lake Theater in Painesville, Ohio, frequently included showings of short subjects, cartoons, sing-alongs, brief comedies, and a seemingly endless procession of James J. Fitzpatrick's travel talks. Most of them dealt with underwater basket weaving in the Trobriand Islands or the picturesque joys of pore patterns in early New England rock walls. You have just heard In a Thousand Years by the travel talker Hans Christian Andersen. Well, now, relentlessly pursuing our theme of celebrating the murky future through the lens of the murky past, we offer the final spike of this Baroque triptych with a jaunt titled In the Year 2889 by no less a futurist than Jules Verne. Now, I would be the last bug to take a bite out of the tush of that great forefather of science fiction by suggesting that Monsieur Verne wrote about futuristic stuff at a point in time when some of his most prominent predictions already existed, such as the submarine. But if such was the case, and I don't want to dispel any myths here, Jules was right on his game in the year 2889. A bit of very tasty extrapolation. Oh, and as a final fillip of fun factoid, I have been advised that in adapting this story, it has been made, if anything, even more Frenchified, a la the drawing room comedy of Feydeau. The story was originally commissioned by the publisher of the New York Herald, Gordon Bennett, the enterprising journalist who sent Stanley into the African jungles to track down Livingston. It was in all the papers. Verne died before it was published, 1905, and critics speculate that his son had a hand in writing it. Whatever. Now, honoring the millennial moment, In the Year 2889, by Jules Verne.
The people of this 29th century live in a perpetual fairyland, though they are totally oblivious to this fact. Surrounded with marvels, they are blasé about marvels. To them, all seems a matter of course. Could they but appreciate the refinements of civilization in our day? Could they but compare the present with the past and recognize the advances we have made? How much fairer they would find our modern towns, with populations exceeding 10 million souls, streets 300 feet wide, houses 100 feet high, with a constant temperature in all seasons, and lines of aerial locomotion crossing the sky in all directions. If they could but imagine the state of things that once existed when, through muddy streets, rumbling boxes on wheels drawn by horses, oh yes, horses, were the only means of conveyance. Think but of the railroads of old.
Your destination, please.
And you will appreciate the pneumatic tubes.
The Champs-Élysées, Paris, France.
Through which today we travel at 100 miles an hour. Would not our contemporaries prize the telephone and teleview more had they not forgotten the telegraph? And what better symbol of our wondrous age than the latest wonder of all, the Great Earth Herald Complex on 253rd Avenue in the nation's capital of Centropolis, which was dedicated only the other day.
This way, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Gordon Bennett Memorial Atrium, the largest enclosed space on Earth, yet occupying only a fraction of the new office block of the Earth Herald.
Are those birdies for real?
Yes, sir. And so are the 2,000-year-old redwoods growing in the food court.
Is all this real gold?
Certainly. Mr. Bennett does everything in the most now of taste.
If Gordon Bennett, founder of the New York Herald, should come back to life today, what would he think when told that this place of marble and gold belongs to his remote descendant, Francis Bennett, who, after 30 generations, is owner of the same newspaper that his ancestor established?
Wow. Oh, that's really interesting.
But how did this Bennett guy get to be so rich anyway? I hear he's worth, like, $300 zillion.
Whoa. Well, Mr. Bennett invented telephonic journalism.
Oh.
When printing was popular 1,000 years ago, a news organization like the Earth Herald would distribute copies of its daily reports on a very fragile sort of cloth called papyrus, sold in the streets and underground. Now, of course, subscribers have a brisk and enlightening conversation with a reporter or a political figure or a scientist.
Right.
And so learn whatever happens to interest them.
Right. Yeah.
Or you can hear it later on the phonograph.
Oh, yeah.
The Herald now has about 85 million subscribers.
Ah.
So the idea must be working.
Yeah.
Well, everybody, please follow me, and you can have a close look at Mr. Bennett's personal collection of artifacts from the late second millennium, which includes a beautiful marble Helvis, god of rocks and music. This way.
Is there a lady?
Mr. Bernstein.
Yes, Mr. Bennett.
That young woman, the tour guide.
Yes, Mr. Bennett.
She has an attractive personality. Perhaps she'd enjoy a transfer to the executive floor.
I'll say to it, Mr. Bennett. Now about the Russian affair.
Yes, a king is he, this Francis Bennett. And in truth, his is a royalty full of burdens. His iron constitution is taxed to the utmost by the heavy strain upon it. Vain the attempt to estimate the amount of labor he undergoes. Only an example can give an idea of it. Let us go about with him for one day as he attends to his multifarious concerns. What day? That matters a little. It is the same every day. Let us take at random, September 25th of this present year, 2889.
Young lady, are you aware that you snore?
His wife left for France 8 days ago.
I'm sorry, Mr. Bennett.
Incredible though it seems, in the 10 years since their marriage, this is the first time Mrs. Edith Bennett, the high fashion model, has been so long absent from home.
Get up and get dressed or you'll be late for work.
Yes, Mr. Bennett.
Use the facility in the guest room. I'm going to call my wife on the teleview.
The teleview. Here is another great triumph of modern science. The transmission of speech is an old story. The transmission of images by means of sensitive mirrors connected by wires is a thing but of yesterday. A valuable invention indeed. Mr. Bennett, this morning, is full of blessings for the inventor, when, by its aid, he is able distinctly to see his wife, despite her great distance.
Oh, Edith. Edith. Edith.
Mrs. Bennett, weary after the ball or the visit to the theatre the preceding night, is still abed, though it is near noontime at Paris. She is asleep, her head sunk in the lace-covered pillows. Mais alors, what? She stirs? Her lips move.
Francis.
This delightful vision gives a happier turn to Mr. Bennett's thoughts.
Young lady, you may ride with me to the Herald, and if you wish, we can stop for a champagne breakfast along the way.
He's left the room, Pierre. Turn off the teleview and come back to bed.
And now, at the call of imperative duty, he lightheartedly springs from his bed and enters his mechanical dresser. 2 minutes later, the machine deposits him all dressed at the threshold of his office.
Mr. Bernstein.
Yes, Mr. Bennett.
What's on tap for today?
Let's see. Your usual Tuesday rounds this morning, Mr. Bennett. The Fiction Bureau, the Science Desk, the Sky Ad Department. Oh, immediately afterward, you have an appointment with the Russian ambassador.
And Tootley Ministers Plenipotentiary of the French Prefectures. Yes, at 11 o'clock. They still disagree about their national borders, I suppose.
If anyone can settle that ancient dispute, it's you, Mr. Bennett. Another item. The British Council has has again requested that the Herald editorialize against the annexation of Great Britain by the United States.
The annexation is 150 years old. Why doesn't Her Majesty just resign herself to the fact that Her Majesty's country is an American possession? Come, come, Mr. Bernstein, we have more important things to take care of. What else?
Well, after lunch, they're expecting you in Niagara.
Call Mrs. Bennett at the Paris apartment and ask her to have lunch with me by teleview.
Sure, Mr. Bennett.
What's on after Niagara?
You don't have to be back until 4:30 for your daily audience with Crackpot and Vanders.
Oh, no, Mr. Bernstein, no editorializing.
Okay, Mr. Bennett. You got a doctor's appointment after that, and then at 10 you're supposed to host the Faithburn resuscitation.
The what?
They're going to revive Dr. Faithburn tonight at your penthouse.
Who the hell is Dr. Faithburn and what is he? Dead or something?
Dr. Nathaniel Faithburn is the guy who put himself into suspended animation 100 years ago today. One of your crackpots.
Bernstein.
Yeah, one of your scientific investigators is going to bring Faithburn's mummy over to your apartment and bring him back to life. Huh. You had me invite a bunch of dignitaries and make a black tie gala out of it.
I did.
Mm-hmm. You also gave the crackpot quite a hefty grant, Mr. Bennett.
I don't remember a thing about it.
Well, it's supposed to be the lead story in tomorrow's edition.
Very well. Do I have to speak?
I put together a few remarks for you, Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Now, let's get to work.
The round of journalistic work begins. First, the hall of novelists, a vast apartment crowned with an enormous transparent cupola. In one corner is a telephone through which 100 Earth Herald literateurs in turn recount to the public in daily installments 100 novels. Bennett addresses one of these authors, awaiting his turn.
Mr. Archibald, I've been listening to Country Manners in my aero car on my way to and from my accumulator works up at the falls. That last chapter was very fine. Oh, very fine.
You like the scene where the young village girl is discussing with her the admirer of some of the problems of transcendental philosophy.
Very keen powers of observation. Keep on that way, Mr. Archibald. 10,000 new subscribers since yesterday, thanks to you.
Oh,
good luck.
Good, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bennett. More to come. More to come.
Now to you, Mr. Last.
Sir, I'm just a summer.
I'm not satisfied with you, Mr. Last. Your story has no life. It's limp. You're in too much of a hurry to get to the end of things.
It's this electrical anathematism angle, Mr. Bennett. I'm not sure.
Right with a scalpel. Dissect. Every action results from a succession of fleeting thoughts. Electrical hypnotism redoubles the subject and separates your twofold personality.
I'm not sure I can handle my one-fold personality as it is, Mr. Bennett.
Get yourself hypnotized, Mr. Last.
I've started the course in my off-time.
Mr. Bernstein. Draw a circle around his name on the screen. John Last. Now, Mr. Bernstein, let us go beard the 1,500 hungry lions in the reporter's room.
Mr. Bennett continues his round and enters the reporter's hall. Here, 1,500 reporters in their respective places, facing an equal number of telephones, are communicating to the subscribers the news of the world as gathered during the night.
Well, Miss Cash, what have you?
Photo telegrams from Mercury, Venus, and Mars, sir. The one from Mars is especially interesting.
Just summarize it.
There's been a revolution in the Central Empire in support of the reactionary liberals against the Republican conservatives.
So, just like us, then?
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Oh, one of our astronomers has discovered a new planet, sir.
Excellent.
We're testing the name Gandini for it. Gandini's orbit from the sun is 12,841,348,248,623 meters, and it takes 572 years, 194 days, 12 hours, 43 minutes, and 9.8 seconds to go once around the sun.
Gandini, huh?
Yeah.
Sounds Indian.
Italian.
Oh, good geopolitics. You know what a passion the public has for these astronomical discoveries?
Yeah.
Get the news out today. Now, what about Jupiter?
Oh, well, nothing so far, sir. Either we can't decode the signals the Jovians make, or our messages haven't yet reached them.
Mr. Peer.
Yes?
What's on your computator?
Here, equations of the 99th degree, Mr. Bennett. I'm working on the formula of algebraical infinity. And Miss Corley here is projecting designs into 24-dimensional space.
Mr. Peer.
Yes?
You are supposed to be editing optical science. Put on your glasses.
Yes.
What about Jupiter? You've all been plugging away at that planet for 20 years, and still we have no reply.
You can't blame optical science. Our last telescope was 2 miles long.
All right, what about the moon? It can't be telescopes we're needing.
No, sir, it's the inhabitants we need.
Are you telling me the moon is uninhabited?
Well, on the face it turns toward us at any rate. I don't know about the other side.
Well, find out.
And how shall I do that, Mr. Bennett?
Turn the damn thing around! Mr. Bernstein?
Yes, sir?
Have our people get to work on some mechanical means of turning the moon around on its axis so we can get in touch with the other side.
Right away, Mr. Bennett.
Seek out the customers wherever they may lurk. What time is it?
Almost 11.
No time for the SkyAd meeting. Cancel it.
Are you sure, Mr. Bennett? We got a crisis on our hands. Hmm. The cloud projectors are idle. We're losing business all over the hemisphere.
What's the problem?
Well, it's a nice day.
Is it?
Yes, sir. No clouds outside the dome to project the advertisements against.
Oh, those projectors seemed an excellent acquisition, Bernstein. Too bad about the poor devil who invented them.
Yes, sir. The pittance you paid him for the idea didn't go far, I hear.
All right. Make a note to talk to Simon Mark of the meteorological staff. Tell him to get to work immediately on the problem of artificial snow-white cloud cover. We just can't continue to lose money because of good weather.
Mr. Bennett's daily tour through the several departments of his newspaper is now finished. Next, he passes to the reception chamber, where the ambassadors accredited to the American government await a word of counsel or advice from the all-powerful editor. A discussion is going on as he enters.
No, it is not
a question of threats, but the Russian Empire is thrust back by the Chinese on the Eastern Front.
Yes.
There is always pressure to attempt, something toward the west.
The map of Greater Europe must remain stable. The north to the Slavs, we have agreed, but the south to the Latins, the present frontier along the Rhine, seems satisfactory to we friends.
We object to the proliferation of weapons on the part of the prefectures of Rome, Madrid, and Vienna.
And so does the Earth Herald, Mr. Ambassador, particularly to the projectiles loaded with the microbes of plague, cholera, and yellow fever, which can destroy a whole nation in a few hours.
We deny the very existence of those projectiles!
Do you, honored gentlemen? And the electric flashes, which can destroy a battalion in an instant? And what about the anti-asphyxiating weapons treaty? Subscribers to the Earth Herald want to know.
Mr. Bennett!
Madam Counsel.
Again, I ask you to campaign against the annexation. It is nearly the 150th anniversary of the American colonization of the United Kingdom.
And Canada and New Britain, and following the Monroe Doctrine, all the 75 stars in the glorious flag of the American Confederation.
You refuse to change your mind?
Madam, I do.
So, that is the end. Australia and New Zealand have their independence. India has long since fallen to the Russians. What is left of all that once was empire?
There's still Gibraltar.
Gibraltar's not running.
In a moment, Beyond 2000 will return with the conclusion of In the Year 2889. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Local underwriting is provided by European Sleepworks, the Berkeley store that offers individually adjusting mattresses in the European style and bedroom furniture in a variety of styles and hardwoods. More details on the web at sleepworks.com.
We believe in fair play here at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. No, really, we do. And so we were thinking, why should somebody be immune from us just because they died 100 years ago? I'm Peter Sagal. Join me, Carl Castle, and special guest Chicago blues legend Buddy Guy as we mock people and things from throughout history in front of a live audience at Chicago's Goodman Theater. This week on the News Quiz from National Public Radio.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me airs tonight at 10 o'clock. Then at 11 after Wait, Wait, you'll hear This American Life, stories from the point of view of the babysitter and the babysat. One story about a brother and sister who didn't have a babysitter. Their controlling mother never left the house. That's This American Life tonight at 11.
Dawson.
And now, Act Two of In the Year 2889.
Interview the president?
I have his story here, sir. He will report that President Wilcox is receiving a series of very high colonics to relieve the stress on his stomach.
Splendid. What about the case of Chapman, the assassin?
We've contacted every person on the jury, sir. They all agree Chapman is guilty. When we publish that, Chapman will be executed before he's sentenced.
Good. Is Mrs. Bennett phone on from Paris? She was still asleep this morning when I looked in.
No, sir, but the telephone view is beside your luncheon plate, as always.
Bernstein, 10 years married, and how much I miss Edith.
That's obvious, sir.
It usually takes her only 2 or 3 days to shop for hats. She's been gone for more than a week.
Oh, you've coped well, Mr. Bennett.
Finally. Please, Mr. Bernstein, can we not find an office suite closer to the newsrooms? I spend more time in this electric armchair than I do at my desk.
Mr. Bennett returns to his chamber. In the mirror of the phono televue is visible the same chamber at Paris which appeared in it this morning. A table furnished forth is likewise in readiness here, for notwithstanding the difference in hours, Mr. Bennett and his wife have arranged to take their meals simultaneously. It is delightful thus to breakfast tête-à-tête with someone 3,000 miles or so away.
And oh, Francis, darling, they are so bewitching this season. They're not like hats at all. They're domes. Cupolas. Atria.
Mm-hmm.
My head is still in the clouds. That's why I'm just a little itty bit late for lunch, Francis, darling.
A little late, as you complain, Lisi, Edith. My plate is as empty as my heart.
Oh, how is that new food service I got you for your birthday, darling?
Well, there are certainly a multitude of choices, and
from A to Z, they said.
And the containers come popping out of these pneumatic tubes quickly enough. I started with the A's, duck aubergineois, with vegetables africaine. Here comes apricot sherbet.
Oh, takeout is the very latest thing, darling. Oh, heavens. Oh, I'll be late for my fitting with Monsieur Wormspire.
Is it Wormspire, the designer who remarks so judicially that woman is only a question of shape?
Well, darling, you shall have no question about my shape after you see the gown Monsieur Wormspire has made. I'm bringing it home with me.
Oh, but when are you coming?
Immediately after the fitting.
Or by tube or aerotrain?
Well, tube, of course. They're so much faster. I arrive at 11:59 this evening.
Paris time?
Centropolis time, silly.
Well, goodbye, then. And be sure not to miss the tube.
Oh, how could I? Goodbye, darling.
I may at least count on the punctuality of women. Everything makes progress except that.
Bennett steps into his air coach, which awaits him at a window.
They're waiting for us at Niagara, Mr. Bennett.
Let's be off, then.
Mr. Bennett has obtained a lease of the Great Falls of Niagara.
Miss Helen Goldwyn will be your in-flight hostess in training.
Who?
The energy developed by the falls went unutilized.
The tour guide you asked me to promote, you slept with her last night?
Bennett, applying Jackson's invention, now collects this energy and sells it.
Oh, yes. She snores, Mr. Bernstein. Book her only for nooners from now on.
Yes, Mr. Bennett. I take it then you don't want her to show at the Fairbanks resuscitation tonight.
What?
The freeze-dried scientists. They're reviving him at your house tonight at 10. We talked about it this morning.
Yes, yes. Great human interest.
Now, you usually have a young lady at your soirees. When Mrs. Bennett is in Paris, they usually stay the night. But if this girl snores,
I don't... Good thinking, Mr. Bernstein. Besides, Mrs. Bennett will be returning. Now, this resuscitation thing, great human interest. Arrange for live coverage.
It is 4 o'clock when Francis Bennett returns, just in time for the daily audience he grants to callers.
Who's outside, Bernstein?
One readily understands how a man in Bennett's position must be flooded with requests of all kinds.
There's a woman of a certain age who claims she has discovered the biogene bacillus, which, when injected, will make the injectee immortal. Or would you prefer the daring young physician who wants to present you with a cure for the common head cold?
A choice must be made between these projects, rejecting the worthless, examining the questionable, accepting the meritorious. To this work, Monsieur Bennett devotes 2 full hours a day.
Neither. The patents on both ideas have long since run out.
There's a young Canadian inventor who proposes that we invest the excess heat from our season balancing system to the purpose of melting the polar ice pack, thereby producing...
More power. Investigate that one. Any more?
Only one. She looks more than, usually intelligent. Dr. Dolores Brannigan from the morgue. Oh, and Dr. Wilkins phoned to say he'd be just as Entropolis second late meeting you at the apartment.
Yeah, well, I know what that means, his new passion for the all-beef martini. All right, send Dr. Brannigan in. Ah, sit down, please, Dr. Brannigan.
Danke. I will make my point quickly, Herr Bennett. I propose to make a human being...
Do you?
There was a time when scientists claimed as many as 75 elements made up the human organism. The number has been reduced to 3, as you're no doubt aware.
Perfectly.
I am on the point of reducing the 3 to 1. If I don't run out of money, I will succeed in 3 weeks.
And then?
I shall have discovered... the absolute.
With what results?
To make the creation of all matter an easy undertaking. Stone, wood, metal...
Surely a human being is harder than a rock.
Complete construction is a certainty, Herr Bennett. The only thing I cannot guarantee is a soul.
Only that? My dear Dr. Brannigan, I'll cover your cost to mock up the bodies. Their souls I can get cheap.
Good evening, Doris Ryback. Here is your news of today.
Just the headlines, okay?
Certainly. Singapore and Calcutta plan to build domes to protect pious populace. England sells Gibraltar to Canadian investor by auction phone. It's always 72 degrees under the dome in Centropolis. Live on your phone at 10, the World Herald's exclusive coverage of the attempt to resurrect Dr. Nathaniel Faithburn.
Thanks.
Certainly.
Give me the funnies.
Sparky and Pito. And there they are in their alley fighting over a piece of the moon. The moon says, "You melons." Pito looks up and he laughs. The moon, in the next picture, the moon says, "You buzzards." And Sparky hits Pito in the behind with a big whack. In the last picture, the two boys are eating the piece of moon like a cookie, and they both say, "Sugar coated," and the moon just looks at them with an angry face.
That old moon.
Now, for Captain Armada and the pirates of Bodice Island.
Bennett dines with his physician. Towards the close of the meal, phono-televuic communication is made with Paris. Bennett sees his wife seated alone at the diner table.
What's the matter, darling? You look crestfallen.
I had to dismiss the au pair.
Pierre? Whatever for?
He was becoming disagreeable about my chaste devotion to you, my darling. And now, here I am alone. I thought you were going to ring me up.
Pardon me, my dear. Dr. Wilkins came by.
Ah, the good doctor. How nice to see you again.
Always a pleasure, Mrs. Bennett.
He came by to examine me and stayed for dinner.
Oh, how is my husband, doctor?
Too much work, too much stress, too much rich food, not enough rest.
How soon will I become a rich widow?
Any day now with luck.
Can't wait. Just teasing, my love. Mm-hmm.
When are you coming home, my dear?
This evening.
Fine. Do you come by tube or by air train?
Oh, by tube.
Yes, and at what hour will you arrive?
About 11, I suppose.
11 by Centropolis time,
yes.
You mean? It's too bad. You'll just miss the awakening of the famous Dr. Faithburn.
Oh, I shall try to make it the next time he wakes up. Goodbye, doctor. I shall call you soon for a checkup.
I promise you my usual thorough examination.
A bientôt, mon cher. Kiss, kiss.
Kiss, kiss.
Okay, people, simmer down, simmer down. Remember, everyone, we're on everybody's phone at 10 sharp. Now get the codex close on the body. Running commentary from Husing and background quotations from Dr. Wilkins and Professor Aronnax. Mr. Bennett has a few remarks. He will arrive from his suite just before phone time, and he will leave soon after. All right, people, back to your jobs, back to your jobs.
Before his guests arrive, Mr. Bennett busies himself with examining his accounts, a task of vast magnitude. The transactions involving a daily expenditure of over $800 million. Fortunately, indeed, the stupendous progress of mechanic art in modern times makes it comparatively easy. Thanks to the piano electro-reckoner, the most complex calculations can be made in a few seconds. In 2 hours, Mr. Bennett completes his task, and just in time. Scarcely has he turned the last page when the distinguished guests arrive. After them comes Dr. Faithburn's body, escorted by a numerous company of scientists. They commence work at once. The casket is laid in the middle of the room. The televue readied. The outer world, already notified, is anxiously expectant, for the whole world will witness the performance.
Hello, Mildred Fogg. This is your personal reporter.
Good evening, Lenny Nemo. This is your personal reporter.
Greetings, Mr. and Mrs. Barbicane. This is your personal reporter from the Earth.
The demonstration of human hibernation is about to unfold before you.
Doctors have just brought in the remains of Dr. Nathaniel Faithburn and...
Wait a minute,
Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Bennett
has taken the floor and is signaling everyone to be silent.
He is about to speak.
Ladies and gentlemen, before we begin, I am reminded of a story. It seems that a priest, a rabbi, and an atheist... On second thought, I don't believe the story worth repeating. Instead, let me introduce Professor Rubor Aronnax of the Faithburn Institute, who will explain what we are about to see tonight. Professor Aronnax.
Thank you. I presume everyone remembers the bold experiment made a century ago by Dr. Nathaniel Faithburn. The doctor being a firm believer in human hibernation, in other words, the possibility of suspending our vital functions and of calling them into action again after a time. He resolved to subject the theory to a practical test. And to this end, having first made his last will and pointed out the proper method of awakening him, having also directed that his sleep was to continue 100 years to a day from the date of his apparent death, he unhesitatingly put the theory to the proof in his own persona. Mm. Now, reduced to the condition of a mummy, Dr. Faithburn was coffined, laid in a tomb, and time went on. September 25th, 2889, being the day set for his resurrection. I applied to Mr. Bennett to permit the second part of the experiment to be performed at his residence here this very evening. He has graciously complied.
No, thank you.
As all is now in readiness, I can see no reason for further delay. Gentlemen, voila!
With the help of his aides, Professor Aronnax has propped the coffin on end.
With the aid of his helpers, the professor is prying off the lid of Dr. Faith Burnside.
They are opening the casket.
Within stands the remains of one of the great visionaries of the 27th century.
Dr. Faithburn's body is now revealed.
A veritable mummy. Yellow,
shriveled,
hard,
leathery, and
dry.
Smelling to high heaven. Oh, they've propped him up and are now using a microwave apparatus
heat
to increase his body
Sir
temperature.
Aronnax is warming it with an applicator. They've put the applicator away and taking out an electrical generator.
An electrical charge is being applied.
The skin seems to be softening almost imperceptibly.
Stand back.
Dr. Faithburn. Dr. Faithburn? Can you hear me? Try to move. Dr. Faithburn. Dr. Faithburn, I bid you walk.
Oh! Dr. Faithburn has fallen.
Dr. Faithburn must have tripped.
Dr. Faithburn is flat on what used to be his face.
Oh! The humanity.
The distinguished Dr. Strogoff Wilkins has
Strogoff
rushed over.
Strogoff Wilkins, society doctor and bon vivant,
one of the guests has come forward to see if he can help with some first aid.
Kneeling over Faithburn.
Aronnax looks a little bit peaked.
This man is dead.
Dead?
Quite dead.
For how long?
I'd guess roughly 100 years, judging by the condition.
Appears as if the Faithburn method wants a few refinements.
I'm devastated. Excuse me, everyone. I must return to the laboratory.
Take your refuse with you. Mr. Bernstein.
Yes, Mr. Bennett.
Some refreshments for our guests. Strike the equipment and do something about the carpet.
All right, you heard Mr. Bennett. Now let's move it.
Well, Dr. Wilkins, what do you think?
Most interesting.
I'll need a new lead for tomorrow's edition. Mr. Bernstein.
Yes, Mr. Bennett.
Go out and get me a new lead for the morning edition. Something exciting. Man bites dog.
Any particular dog, Mr. Bennett?
Preferably a vicious dog, Mr. Bernstein.
Yeah, right away, Mr. Bennett.
So much for that experiment. But if poor Faithburn is dead, at least he is sleeping. I wish I could get some sleep. I am exhausted, Doctor. Completely exhausted.
Well, a nice hot bath will refresh you. But you must wrap yourself up well before you go out into the hallway. You must not expose yourself to cold.
Hallway? Why, Doctor, as you well know, everything is done by machinery here. It is not for me to go to the bath. The bath will come to me. Just look what happens when I press this button.
Oh.
Edith. You're home.
Such, in the year 2889, is the history of one day in the life of the editor of the Earth Herald. And the history of that one day is the history of 365 days every year, except leap year, and then of 366 days. For as yet, no means has been found of increasing the length of the terrestrial year.
This installment of Beyond 2000, you have been listening to In a Thousand Years by Hans Christian Andersen, followed by In the Year 2889 by David Osman and Yuri Rasovsky, based on a story by Jules Verne. In the cast you heard, Phil Proctor as Jules Verne, Patria Burchard as Edith, Janet Fontaine as the tour guide, David Dukes as Bennett, Hamilton Camp as Bernstein, Brian Finney as Dr. Wilkins, and George Murdoch as Aronax, with Laura Kellogg, Sandy Orkin, and Melinda Peterson. The plays were produced and directed by Yuri Rasovsky. Warren Dewey, Jamie Siniglia, they were the engineers.
It's almost midnight. We're only seconds away from the new year.
And the new millennium.
Do you think there's any credence to what they say? You know, about the millennium bug?
We can only wait and see. When the first millennium rolled around, all sorts of dire things were predicted, but nothing happened. And then when the second millennium came, there was the first talk of some sort of millennium bug. But that turned out a false alarm, too. Especially since they were reckoning the new millennium a year too soon, in 2000 CE instead of 2001.
Well, that's just stupid.
What do you expect from such primitives? But then, the third millennium arrived, and you know what happened then.
Yes. Every school child knows. Precisely on the first stroke of 24 International Standard Time, giant insect-like creatures from outer space launched a coordinated all-out worldwide offensive.
Humanity was nearly wiped out. Millions upon millions died before the conflict wound down.
Civilization, as it was then known, ended.
As did mankind's ascendancy on this planet.
And a good thing, too. Had mankind continued its irresponsible reign, the Earth would have soon become uninhabitable.
As it was, it took nearly the next 1,000 years for the biosphere to readjust.
To heal.
Yes, to heal. Well put. Thank goodness a new civilization arose that corrected the mistakes of the old.
We now live in a truly golden age.
No more war.
No more hunger.
No more injustice.
Nature returned to balance.
Nay, nature improved, enlarged and improved. The weather regulated.
Tectonics and vulcanization harnessed.
Earth's rotation and orbit adjusted for maximum life enhancement.
All species of flora and fauna thriving harmoniously together amidst the wonder and beauty and grandeur of this extraordinary little world.
But they say that tonight all this will end.
They say. Who are they?
It's possible. You cannot deny it. Vestiges of the old civilization may still exist. The pre-millennium bug colonies on other planets and artificial worlds were unscathed by the cataclysm of 3000 CE.
No, but they haven't been seen or heard of since the fall of the old terrestrial empires. If they were anything like their earthbound fellows, they must have destroyed themselves eons ago.
Yet remnants of the old civilization remain even here on Earth.
Mere anachronisms.
So it seems, nevertheless, the rumors.
The new millennium bug?
Yes, the new millennium bug.
Oh, far-fetched.
There are more things on heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. I keep an open mind.
We haven't long to wait for proof. The countdown is about to start.
10.
9, 8,
7,
6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Merciful heaven!
It can't be!
It is humans!
Human beings everywhere!
Oh! I've been shot in the thorax! Run! Save yourself!